26th SCCA meeting. And it's very nice to see such a nice crowd on a beautiful day. Would you all please rise to the Pledge of Allegiance? Pledge of Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you. We have a number of things going on this morning. And for announcements, as you all know, we had a very good legislative year this year. And I want to thank everyone here and anybody that you know that wrote a lot of the letters that we asked for the governor and for the state. As you know, we're able to get through some good legislation to help the communities. This was made possible by a large group of people throughout the entire state of Florida finally putting their heads together and coming up with something that works. Mr. Gary Polyakov will be explaining it in much more detail later on. He'll also be taking your questions. So if you have any questions, please write them on an index card, give them to a board member or at either one of the entrance tables, and we'll see to it that Mr. Polyakov gets them. We also have a seminar going on September 8th, given by ServPro on mold remediation. If anybody wants to get involved in that particular, go to that seminar. There's also CAM and real estate credits that will be given for that course. See Dana. She should be around someplace here. She can sign up or check our website. The information is in there under educational. I'd like to thank Existing Structures and Engineering for the goodies that you're all eating this morning. We have a few guests this morning. We have a Brevard County Circuit Court Judge, Mr. Mike Rudisell. Mike, would you like to say a few words? We also have some of the historical flyers that were given out. They're all free. They're given out by Joseph Morgan from the Brevard County Historical Commission. And I don't think he brought enough, but for those of you who have got it, it's an interesting little flyer. Gary Polyakov's book, as you know, is up on sale there. It's a reasonable price. And if you haven't read it, I recommend you read it. It's absolutely excellent. We have also here today, we have a candidate who's running for Port Canaveral Authority District 5, Mr. Tom Weinberg. Tom, would you like to say a few things to the crowd?
I didn't hear him when he asked me if I wanted to say a few words. So, I'm a judge, so of course I always take an opportunity to say a few words. I'm Michael Rudisell. I am one of your sitting circuit judges in the 18th Judicial Circuit. That is all of Seminole and all of Brevard County. And I handle, at the moment, civil and family cases, as well as volunteering to do juvenile drug court. I like what I do. I'd like to continue to serve the people of Brevard and Seminole counties for many, many years to come. I've got some literature. Some of you already have it. If you'd like to learn more about me, please stop and say hi. And I've got some literature my wife does back this summer with the Cameron. She's got some as well. And thank you very much for this opportunity to speak to you all.
Thanks, Roger, and good morning to everybody. What a nice crowd. My name is Tom Weinberg, running for Port Commissioner, District 5, and it's an unknown fact, at least most people don't understand it, but if you live anywhere north of Panayi Causeway, you'll vote on each of the four commission districts that are up for election during this cycle. So August 24th, I hope you'll vote in the primary, certainly in the November 2nd general election. A little bit about me. I was born here in 1960. 1949 in Rockledge, excellent product of a multi-generation family. My great-grandfather was part of 40 men, a group of 40 men that incorporated the city of Cocoa in 1895. We live here in Cocoa Beach on South Banana River Boulevard, and my wife Linda is here with me today. Linda, if you could stand up. She's an attorney, great asset in a campaign. The couple of issues about the port, I really want to just mention the four key issues you'll see in the card that's been given out, and that's security. You know, we've got to have a secure port and make sure that we don't have any problems with any terrorism or anything like that, and that's important. The other is ethics. You've read in the paper and you've heard some of the rhetoric about problems with ethical lapses at the port. There have been a couple. The Orlando Business Journal covered that, and frankly, I think enough is enough of that kind of nonsense, cronyism, and corruption. So if you can help me, I hope you will. The third is environment and recreation. I, you know, growing up here, had the opportunity to enjoy the port. I hope we maintain the character of our port, because it's a great place to go fish, it's a great place to go to Jetty Park and enjoy the restaurants and what they have to offer in the cove, regardless of what happens with both cargo and the cruise lines. And the last point is the economy. With the downturn, or the, you know, what's happening with NASA and the 8,000 job layoff, it's really important that we develop our assets. The port is a tremendous asset. There are two large parcels of land out there that can be developed to bring more people in to help this economy. And if you're a condo owner and still own a couple, I think it's really important, both in, you know, the real estate market and for jobs, that we buttress our economy and do all we can to make it stronger and better. So with that, I hope you'll vote August 24th and look forward to your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
Now, we've had requests and inquiries numerous times regarding bulk cable packages. Are there alternatives? Well, AT&T has a U-verse system, and Mr. Dan Siplin is here today to give you a brief rundown. He has, again, 5 minutes, and then he'll set up in the back. You can network with him afterwards if you want further information or get on his list. Dan?
Hey, Mr. Castleback. First of all, I'd like to say thank you for giving me the opportunity to present AT&T to the forum. I'm running to get 30 years so that I can retire. But to talk about the service of AT&T, it is a brand new service. We are moving to the East Coast. We had an opportunity to do a presentation the month of March. And we talked about the service. We were under the impression that as we were moving forward, we were better prepared to deliver the service quickly. But as we started to working on our infrastructure, we did find that there was some delays to some of the properties that we presented to. And we would like to, at this point, say we're still there. We're working very hard to clear those issues up, and we will be delivering the service very soon. Just to give you a quick overview of the AT&T service to make sure that we understand the difference in AT&T and the conventional cable company that you probably have right now. Our signal is delivered totally different. We started in the business probably 2 or 3 years ago, and when we started, we decided to use the latest and greatest technology, and I think the best illustration to help you to appreciate the difference is an 8-track tape and a CD. You know, some of us still have 8-track tapes. I do. I have VHS tapes, but my kids have DVDs. And as long as I keep my recorder, I can play my VHS, but my kids always use DVDs. Well, when we came into the business, we took the latest and greatest technology, which was digital. Our entire system is digital. We do not have an analog system. So if you're interested in AT&T, you will have the latest and the greatest technology to provide the service. Currently, right now, you may be using analog and digital, having a box to convert to the digital signal, but we only deliver digital. We have the highest content of HD channels. Your home becomes a total home DVR system, which means that you can begin to record on one television, go to another room, and pick up the same recording in the other room. You can also record up to 4 channels at one time, which is unheard of in the industry to date. In addition to that, if you do elect to get a high-speed internet, your entire home becomes Wi-Fi. So you can actually have a wireless network within your home. So we lend ourselves towards creating an environment in your home of total technology. And there's some other details that we can also go into if you would come back to to my counter bikes there. Now, in addition to that, I do want to mention that AT&T has never been the lowest cost provider because we live on the value and the quality of our service. We honestly feel that we are delivering the best quality service in the marketplace today. And thus far, we won the J.D. Power Award to demonstrate that as well. So we're not going to be the lowest cost provider, but we're going to be the dependable provider that you can depend on. And not only just for today, the technology that we're going to provide is going to continue to be expanding, not only today, but years to come. Also, in addition to that, we offer bundles that will allow you not only to bundle high-speed phone and video, but you can also bundle wireless. You know, we just came out with the new 4G phone. I don't know if anyone has it. I'm still on 1G, and I'm going to wait till they get to 6 before I buy one. But the point I'm saying is we do have the new phone. That can be a part of your bundle for your home with AT&T. And as you look at our competitors, you may want to ask the question, can they do that as well? But those are some of the highlights of what we do offer as far as the AT&T UVerse service. Now, as I mentioned, this is a new area. We're moving into the area. There are some pockets, some locations that we can't provide the service as of yet. I am going to be providing Ms. Beverly, President's Forum, Mr. Kasselbeck, a list of the new properties that we just turned what we call green to be able to provide the service. It's about 30 properties that we just got an opportunity to provide services to. So we are moving ahead. We are turning properties green as quickly as possible. But if you would stop by my table, I'd be glad to take your information, do an analysis, and let you know when we're going to be able to provide service to your property. I look forward to it, and thank you once again.
Thank you, Doug. The next, one quick announcement. We have a vendor here that for 2 years running, the Brevard Green Team has won the Sustainable Florida Award for becoming greener and helping the environment. It's the first time that a grassroots organization has done it 2 years in a row where they only started 8 months before the first nomination. So how about a round of applause for the Green Team? The next President's Forum will be on July 10th. And I didn't get corrected. Today we have Mr. Gary Polyakov, senior partner and co-author of New Neighborhoods, the Guide to Community Living. He's here to hopefully help us understand what the changes were in 1196, how they're going to affect you. And again, if you have questions, please write them down on index cards, give them to the tables, and I will make sure that Gary gets them. Thank you very much. Mr. Polyakov?
Thank you.
All right. Just make sure you don't have any shock treatment here.
Does
that work?
Yeah. You can put the rest of this in your front pocket. I'll let you do that.
Okay, thank you.
When I point to you, go.
Okay.
Good morning. I sort of feel like it's the ground hole they use each year to determine whether or not winter will be extended or not, because I've been invited and have had opportunity to speak here at Space Coast for probably 20, 25 years. And you know, when Gary Polyakov is here speaking, that means that now you can pack your bags. It's time to head back up north. The summer has truly started. But it's my thrill to be here and have been part of watching this organization grow over the many, many years. I've just come back from a book tour with my new book. Some of you are here to hear myself and my son Ryan, who co-authored New Neighborhoods, speak about the book a number of months back. Since then, we've probably been out at about 40 different locations, stage, radio, television, and I just ended up with a book signing at Caesars in Las Vegas as part of the Community Associations Institute National Conference. I happened to look this morning, New Neighborhoods remains among the top 100 best-selling books on Amazon.com. In fact, last night it was the number 2 and has frequently been number 1. And I think it's not so much about the great writings of myself and my son, but if any of you, and we do have, by the way, some copies of New Neighborhoods over there, and I do want to mention that part of the proceeds of the sales today go to the Community Association, to the Space Coast Community Association. But you'll notice on the back a wonderful quote from Harry Charles, one of the founders of Space Coast. And so I attribute Harry's great quote to the reason the book sells so well. Thank you, Harry. I also have put out something that has been a particularly important thing to me is disaster preparedness and recovery. We are in the hurricane season. There is the first of the tropical storms forming off the Yucatan, and there hasn't been a storm that has hit the state of Florida in the past 25 years that I haven't personally been at the location immediately following the storms to deal with the issues of disaster preparedness, disaster recovery, and the various issues that come up. And based upon firsthand experience of dealing with initially Andrew and all the storms that followed that, and the rash of hurricanes that came through here about 3 or 4 years ago, I authored a pamphlet called Disaster Recovery and Planning. They're absolutely free. I had a stack of them at the back table. I highly recommend that every community association, condos, co-ops, homeowner associations have a disaster preparedness plan. And you really should be using today's technology, which basically is web technology, to be able to communicate to your residents who have to evacuate and may not be able to return for a considerable period of time. Now, there is a whole section of the Condominium Act that we had something to do with writing that deals with disaster relief. And I was using the word relief, the rights and powers of an association following a hurricane, including the ability to compel owners to leave the property and not be able to return until it's safe to do so. And the best way to communicate to the owners is through web technology or through messages, phone numbers where individuals can call in on a regular basis, and or, quite frankly, the reverse, where the association sends out messages pre-recorded to all the owners at addresses that you give them, your phone numbers, your email addresses. I own a condominium personally at a beach resort, and probably once or twice a week I get a phone call from the condominium telling me of some event that's taking place, or if the power is shut off to a particular section of the building, or a water break is in the building. These are things that are very important to the owners. Information is critical, particularly following a disaster, but do have a plan in place, and do understand your responsibilities as it relates to preparing a loss assessment, your claims following a storm. The single greatest pitfall, and I've written about this in my columns, is that associations may have legitimately $2, $3, $4, $5 million worth of claims, and they file one claim involving $1,000 that's non-legitimate, and it's deemed to be fraudulent, and under Florida law, it voids the entirety of the claim of the association. And I've read several cases recently where courts have ruled that the entire claims have been disallowed because of a false claim and an inconsequential amount of money. So please do understand the requirements of the time requirements that you have to file your claim, how to document your claim, what goes into the claim, what you can and cannot do. But more importantly, even before the hurricane hits, is to be sure you have a disaster plan in place and that you have a disaster coordinator who will be there to help you. Now, I'd also be remiss if I didn't mention that another thing about June, this comes up every year as I'm a speaker, and that is June is also my anniversary month. And yesterday I celebrated my 43rd wedding anniversary, and my beautiful wife is here with me. Sherry, stand up, say hello. 43 years. And, of course, she and I are now proud grandparents of three lovely grandchildren. So you've been able to watch me and my family grow because my son Ryan was also, his co-author, was here speaking last time. What I've been asked to do today, and one other thing, I'd also be remiss if I didn't say, Thank you for your support and readership of the column of mine that appears in your local newspaper. Some of you may be aware of the fact that the paper, in order to try and save money at some point, decided they were going to cut out a number of the columns, and one of the columns that they had eliminated was my own. But the response from the readers were so overwhelming, particularly the Space Coast Community Association, that I finally got a call from the new managing editor saying, please call off the dogs. I'll put the column back in the newspaper. I understand it now appears in the Sunday paper. I do my best to respond to as many of the questions that are asked. But the column does appear in some 15 newspapers every week. And I'm humbled to receive about 100 letters a week. And if you think about that, that's quite a few letters a year, and it's impossible. They would have to give me the entire newspaper in order to be able to respond to them all. So I take a sampling of the letters I get, and I do my best to respond. And that was also one of the reasons we wrote New Neighborhoods, so that if there are some questions that perhaps I do not get to by reading New Neighborhoods, you'd have an opportunity to have some of your thoughts clarified. What I have here, and this is not exaggerated, that is the legislation that passed this year dealing with condominiums, co-ops, and homeowner associations. Every page of this. To sit and go through the entirety of this, we would be here until next June. So my challenge today is to try to sift this down to some of the more critical issues that the legislature dealt with. And I can tell you that there would be no legislation if it were not, and I'm not just saying this because you're here, if it were not for the efforts of the Space Coast Community Association, which remains one of the most active participants in the legislative process, They're there speaking to not only your local representatives, they're there in Tallahassee. They speak to the leadership, they speak to the people who are making the laws, and they have a significant input into what is ultimately written into the law. Both condominium cooperatives and plan developments governed by homeowner associations, to give you an idea of the exponential growth of this field. And I've mentioned it before, but it's worth repeating. In the United States today, there are now 300,000 community associations governing 24.5 million homes, resided in by close to 60 million individuals. One in every 20 Americans now live in a community governed by a mandatory membership association. And they have an annual budget collectively of about $41 billion. Here in the state of Florida, we guesstimate that there is 45,000 associations, both condominium and homeowner associations and cooperatives. Now, to put that in perspective for you, in the entirety of this country, there are only 85,000 municipal and state governments. So a large part of the services that historically were performed by local government have now been transferred over to contractual governments, quasi-municipal governments, performing security and waste management and social services. And of course, they also, which we'll talk about later, are being impacted, as is government, by severe cash shortages caused by delinquencies in payment of owners and the largeness of the number of foreclosures that are taking place in the state. Florida is third in the nation in foreclosures. Last year, the Supreme Court of Florida noted there were 500,000 foreclosures already in place. And since the beginning of the year, there have been tens of additional thousands added to that. As a direct result, the Supreme Court of Florida has issued a mandate. There can be no more foreclosures filed in the courts of the state of Florida prior to the individuals going to mediation. Now, I'm not so sure what will be accomplished in mediation. As a matter of fact, you may have read it in the news this past week. The federal government tried a homeowner's modification bill of the Homeowners Affordability Act, where they tried to get the banks to work with the individual borrowers to freeze the amount of the loan, extend it over a greater period of time, even to cram down the mortgages to reduce the mortgage in line with the home value where the individuals were upside down in their homes. But the report said that notwithstanding those efforts, 75% of individuals who have gone through the process ended up losing their homes anyway, which just places that largeness of empty property back onto the market. And we don't see a solution in the short term, but we're going to talk about some of the things that the legislature has done. Now, what we're going to talk about today is three basic bills. Senate Bill 1196, which was the bulk of the legislation, and covered both condo, co-op, and HOA. We're going to talk about House Bill 663, which dealt with the requirement of retrofitting for fire sprinkler systems under the Life Safety Act, and House Bill 1035 dealing with elevator safety. I have a URL, a website listed for you of call a community association leadership lobby, which is a arm of my law firm at Becker & Polyakoff. And we have a synopsis of some of these bills at that site. So if any of you are not able to follow fully today what we're talking about, you might want to also take a look at the website where it does have a summary of some of those bills.
It's www.floridacondohoalawblog.com. I'm sorry, I didn't advance forward. There you go. Okay. Okay, let's first take a look at fire sprinklers. There is a law in the state of Florida that requires that buildings that were over 75 feet in height retrofit to put hardwired fire sprinkler systems within the units and fire alarms within the units and fire sprinklers in the common areas and the common elements. There was an effort 2 years ago to, because of the economic crisis being experienced by shared ownership communities, to defer the implementation of that date until 2025. Because quite frankly, in some cases, the cost of retrofitting can run as much as $1 million to $2 million or more. That happened to the bill. It passed. It was part of a more extensive bill. The governor vetoed it. He vetoed it because he said he was concerned about the safety issue, about the possibility of condominiums burning down because they did not have adequate fire protection in them. Today it's not an issue because all new buildings built of those heights are fire sprinklers and have the alarm systems in it. This year, a provision passed which allows unit owners and those buildings that are required to retrofit for fire sprinklers to opt out of doing so. But the vote, by a vote of a majority of the total voting interest. It used to be two-thirds, it's now a majority. You can also extend the time for retrofitting until 2019. But if you extend, you have to pull your permit by 2016. Now, here's a glitch in the bill. Here's a glitch that very few people noticed, and quite frankly, in the rush at the end of the session, we were concerned about, is the governor now going to veto all of 1196 because of the same reason he vetoed the bill 2 years ago? And we finally figured out why he didn't do so. What they deleted from the bill is a provision that allowed you to opt out from the engineered life safety system requirements. So even though you have a legal right to opt out of the mandatory retrofitting, you cannot opt out of the local fire marshal's mandate that you retrofit your building for engineered life safety systems that they determined to be required. Few noticed that, by the way, at the time the bill passed. But if you go back now and you read this voluminous document of the bill, you'll see that language of engineered life safety being stricken from the right to be able to opt out of the bill. Just say your local fire marshal comes along and you just heard me say that the law clearly says that you can vote to opt out of the retrofitting for the fire, hardwired fire alarm for sprinklers, and he says, I don't care. Locally, we want every condominium 75 stories or higher to be fire sprinkled and alarmed. I think it's going to become a local political issue.
But do note that that is now in the bill, the opt-out, and it sits right alongside the side that says that the local fire marshal still has the jurisdiction and the authority to decide what you have to do in your respective areas. Let's assume your association has voted to opt out of retrofitting. By a petition of 10% of the owners, which can be done every 3 years, you may have a group of owners that says that I appreciate the cost, I also appreciate the advantage, and I'm prepared to pay the cost. We want a vote taken to retrofit. Not retrofit, but to retrofit. The statute now allows those owners by petition to mandate that there be a vote of the owners to determine whether or not to have retrofitting required. This is pretty much the same thing on the fire alarm system, so we're going to pass by that one. Distressed Property Relief Act of 2010. There are thousands of condominiums in this state that are sitting empty, and buildings that are under construction, units that have been abandoned. We have situations where individuals are squatting in units. I don't know if you've had that problem up here. We have in the news just this past week where a woman was arrested. What is she doing? And this is not the first case. She is listing for sale or lease units that are in bank foreclosure and are empty and or have been abandoned. And unfortunately, there are some very gullible people who come along and they give her cash to rent the units or to buy the units, and then sooner or later the owner of the bank shows up and finds someone living in these units and says, who are you, why are you here? And they say, well, I leased it or bought it from X. Of course, X is long gone with the money somewhere or pulling the scam elsewhere. This is a problem. We have a severe cash problem in a number of communities where in some cases upwards of a third of the owners are not paying their share of the common expenses or doing so late. We have banks that are foreclosing but not taking title. Why don't banks take title? Because they understand clearly that if you take title, you're a unit owner. And you then become liable for not only the safe haven of paying 1 month of assessment, but all assessments that come on owed from the time you take title, including, let's assume, a hurricane comes through. And there's casualty losses, and there's special assessments that are levied. A bank which owns the title then becomes a unit owner obligated to pay their share of the common expenses. And we're going to talk in more detail about this later on, about some of the what I'll call gimmicks some people are trying to use to try to compel banks to expedite their foreclosure process and what the courts have said about that. We need to figure out some way to infuse cash into condominiums that are experiencing these problems, and we need to get this largeness of unsold, unoccupied units off the market into the hands of people that will start contributing their share of the common expenses. So we wrote last year, it did not have its hearing, included in 1196 this year, the Distressed Property Relief Act of 2010. And what this says is that if anyone buys seven or more units, the key is seven, the key here, once they buy it, they're an owner, they're now obligated to pay their share of the common expenses. But what did we have to give up to entice these vulture funds and investors to buy up these large inventory of unsold units? We had to tell them we would allow them the following. This is a sunset law. Do you know what that means? It's only for a limited duration. It will only apply, I believe, for 2 years. And what this law says is that if you buy 7 or more units, you are not going to be treated as a developer to the extent that you did not actually build the unit, build the condominium. Why is that important? The Vulture funds didn't want to buy up the units because they said as soon as we take title, we're going to get slapped with a warranty lawsuit. We're going to be required to fund converter reserves. We're going to be held liable as a developer for all the actions and conducts that take place while we run the association. So that's what this bill is, which is part of 1196. It is an attempt to get the unsold inventory of units off the market by providing some protection for individuals who are willing to buy up these units in bulk. Perhaps the most important part of what we're going to talk about today, insurance. Where's Roger? I don't see. Where'd he go? Can find him? I'll tell Harry. Harry, you tell Roger. The manner in which we mandate insurance coverage in Florida is contrary to what all 49 other states does, and I think is wrong and it needs to be changed. But it is what it is. Every state in Florida originally had what we call bare wall coverage. And that said basically, the association is responsible to ensure all improvements as originally built by the developer. And the only thing that would be excluded would be the personalty, your couches, your furniture, and any upgrades you did to your unit. And that way, if a building burns down, you have one insurance company that's responsible to go in and to rebuild the structure. But we had problems over the years, and the price of insurance was escalating. And as humorous in hindsight as some of this stuff sounds, it's actually truth. We had a period of time when people would always find means of trying to have their units upgraded by claiming that they had some casualty that caused damage to their kitchen cabinets. One best example actually happened of a lady who would do her ironing on the kitchen cabinet. She put down the sheet, she did her ironing, she left the iron on, it burned a iron spot in the top of the cabinet, files an insurance claim against the association. Next thing you know, she gets all new kitchen cabinets. Another lady doing a laundry drops a bottle of bleach on the ground. Ah, my carpeting, it's ruined. I need all new carpeting. Filed a claim with the association. She got new carpeting. Next thing we know, we have claims all over the state of people with bleach, with fires, everything. So the Florida legislature meets, and it passes a law saying, look, in order to keep insurance costs from escalating, we're going to provide that the association is responsible for ensuring all improvements and replacements of like kind and quality, except certain defined components we're going to exclude from the coverage. At the time, we referred to those as the dirty dozen because there were 12 of them. Unit wall coverings, floor coverings, ceiling coverings, kitchen cabinets, appliances, curtains, AC units, heating units, and those components must be covered by the unit owner under their HO6 policies. Mandatorily, that's where they're covered. A few years go by, and then around 2008, the law changes, and they take that AC units that are outside the unit, Again, keep in mind, previously, if you had an air conditioning compressor that sat on the roof of the unit, of the building, or on the ground, that compressor was covered by the unit owner under DH06. So they passed the law saying if the component is not in the unit boundaries, it's part of the association responsibility. That is still the law today. We thought when they did 1196, they were going to replace that as one of the components to be covered by the unit owner. But they didn't. But I'm going to tell you in a moment how, if you feel strongly, and some of you do, I received a lot of letters saying, do you know what additional cost that has added to the association if we have to now, following a hurricane, replace all the unit compressors as part of the common expenses of an association? Yes, I do know the cost. I know because you've told me. The AC units can, under one condition, be restored as a unit owner cost, and it's provided for in this law. You won't find it looking for it, but I'm going to explain to you where it is. It says that if there is a limited common element, now you know what a common element is. There's only two components to every condominium. And for those of you who are in homeowner associations, don't worry, there's a lot in this law that deals with homeowner association. And so same thing with cooperatives. But in the condominium context, the two components of every condominium are the units, which is the part of the property that is subject to private ownership, and everything else. Anything that's not a unit is a common element. But some of the common elements are reserved for the exclusive use of a unit or a group of unit owners. What's a classic example of a limited common element? Balcony. Another one. Parking spaces. Storage units. It could be some walkways, patios. What you'll find in the law is a section that says if there is a limited common element, by a vote of the membership to amend the declaration, you can transfer the obligation for maintaining and replacing that common element to the unit owner that has the exclusive use of that common element. Now, there's some danger area here, depending upon one's perspective. Let's say you live in one of those condominiums that are wrapped with balconies. My son has one of the most immense balconies I've ever seen. They wrap the entire unit. And he's right on the ocean, and we know if you're on an ocean in a condominium with balconies, you're going to have balcony restoration. It's the same as they say, death and taxes. I can guarantee you, if you have a unit on the ocean, you're going to do balcony restoration, the single biggest expense you'll ever have in a condominium. My own bookkeeper recently told me that she had a special assessment for balcony restoration of $50,000. That's a lot. But now you have a law that says, by an amendment to the declaration, if the balconies are deemed to be common elements and the cost of replacement is that of the association as a common expense, you can vote to say those balconies are the obligation of the unit owner to whose unit they abut and to which they are a limited common element. I'm not here to tell you that that's something you should do or shouldn't do. I'm here to tell you that's what the law now says. And it's that same law that you can also use if you want to use it to say that those unit air conditioning units, the compressors that are outside the unit boundaries, if you want to shift it back over to the unit owner, that's how you go about making that change. Do you remember a couple of years ago they passed a law saying that every HO6 had to carry a provision for $2,000 to cover special assessments? The person who wrote the law obviously didn't understand insurance. It was never intended to cover special assessment. A special assessment is just what it says. It's when you need a budgetary amendment to cover some special purpose, such as a capital improvement or an alteration of the common element. What were they thinking? What was the word they were thinking of? It wasn't special assessment. So I heard it over here. Loss assessment. Loss assessment and special assessment are two totally different foreign concepts. A loss assessment is in a situation where the association has insurance and insures a component in the building, but due to the deductible or the inadequacy of the funds to rebuild, you have to levy a special assessment to the unit owners to make up the difference to restore that component. That is called loss assessment insurance. And under law today, no option, every HO6 policy issued has to have $2,000 of coverage for loss assessment. Loss assessment does not cover an uninsured component. There is a lot associated with your property that you cannot buy insurance for. One of the biggest losses you'll have in a hurricane is painting, the pool that gets under a storm surge washed out into the ocean, the landscaping. You're not going to buy insurance for that. You cannot get loss assessment for that. Loss assessment covers a insured component, and it's not even optional. You didn't have to ask for it. It's mandatory. When you buy that homeowner's policy, it's now going to be in there. Now, there was another provision in the law that I had a personal problem with, and a lot of people had a problem with me for having a problem with it. Maybe it's my political philosophy. I don't believe in forcing people, once they understand consequences, to do something that they might not necessarily can afford to do or feel that they want to do. And we had a provision in the law last year, but up until July 1st, and everything we're talking about right now takes effect July 1st. It's not too far off. Everything I'm telling you now becomes effective July 1st. We had a provision in the law that said the association can require every unit owner to have homeowner's insurance and to furnish the association evidence of that insurance. And if they don't do so, this is what I objected to. The association could force place coverage. I could not see the state's 45,000 associations out shopping the market, buying insurance on individual units, and then telling the unit owner, you owe us X amount of dollars. I fully support the concept that every unit owner needs to have homeowners insurance, casualty, liability. And I still feel that one of the questions that's asked me is, can we still say to a unit owner, give us evidence that you have insurance on the unit? I see no problem with that. But I do not feel the association should be the entity that, with all its issues, is out there force placing insurance on individual unit owners. So that's been removed from the law, the force place insurance. There was also a poorly written provision in the law that I called immediately and said, who wrote this? And what it said was that if you have the exclusive use of a component of the property, a limited common element, that you are responsible for the restoration in the event of a casualty. That wasn't the intent of the person who wanted that drafted. What they wanted was if you make an upgrade to an improvement, you're responsible for the upgrade. But that's not what they wrote in the law. They wrote that any common element to which you had the exclusive use, in the event of a casualty, you solely are responsible for the cost of replacing that, and that included the unit balconies, without your knowledge or your agreeing to be responsible. That's been changed in the law. That's no longer there. What's there is what I've already told you. The association is responsible for the common elements and the limited common elements unless the members vote to shift the burden over to individual unit owners. Remember we used to talk about hazard insurance? No longer use that term. It's been stricken throughout the law. Now when we talk insurance, it's property insurance. So everything when you talk about insuring your condominium, it's property insurance, not hazard. Two basic types of insurance you're buying is property and liability. Same with the association. The board, and also, how much insurance do you buy? It's mandated. You have no choice. The cost of replacement. No other options. No co-insurance. No an agreed amount. In Florida, the association must buy insurance for the cost of replacement. And how do you determine by the cost of replacement? An appraisal done every 3 years. Insurance appraisal. Now that could be very costly. You may want to have deductibles. You want to accept some of the risk. You can do it. The current law, for one more day, says the board calls a meeting to determine what deductible it wishes to take on its insurance policy. It must provide with specificity the considerations for those deductibles. That's been deleted. The board still needs to give notice to all unit owners of the board meeting at which it will discuss the insurance and the insurance deductible. What's not any longer required is the specificity in the notice as to the deductible options. And why did we change that? We changed that, quite frankly, because unfortunately, you have situations where someone reads the notice, they read the agenda, the board gets in the meeting, and they are presented options that weren't considered, and say, this is a better option, and someone says, you can't approve that, that wasn't in the agenda. So we've taken out that specificity requirement of the law, and all you have to do is provide the notice of the board meeting, but you can take deductibles, and what are those deductibles based upon? Industry standards of comparable units in your community. And deductibles, and some people call it self-insurance, is a wise thing to do. You base it upon how much money you have in reserves, what is the pain threshold of your individual owners to be able to sustain a special assessment in relationship to what the actual cost of insurance. Don't do what one South Florida, Lauderdale Lakes or Daughter Hill condominium did 2 months ago. Park South, the condo burns to the ground. Fortunately, it wasn't an overly large one. It was 24 units, no insurance. Why was there no insurance? The board said they decided they would take the risk instead of paying the premiums because they were having cash problems. I had the same thing in the Florida Panhandle following, I forget which storm now, in which a storm surge came in. This isn't exaggerated. It undermined the entire building. It was a timeshare up there, and the whole thing was out in the ocean. No flood insurance. The association is the entity that has the legal liability to buy flood insurance, not individual owners. And if you have mortgages on your units, it's not optional. A lender cannot loan money in a unit in a flood zone unless there is flood insurance. Now, you've read a lot in the paper lately about the fact that Congress adjourned initially without passing an extension of the law allowing for buying flood insurance. They just recently, I believe, convened or passed the law to allow you to buy flood insurance. And all insurance has to be bought, I believe, it's 30 days before a hurricane warning is issued? Something like that. You can't buy it once the warning is issued. So I know the pain of insurance. I know the risk, and I do know their association, notwithstanding all these admonitions, that are going to still say, we're not going to buy flood insurance, we're going to take the risk, we're not carrying casualty insurance. Okay, what it all comes down to is whether or not there might be a potential liability of individual directors for breach of fiduciary duty and not following the statutory mandate. Although I will tell you that there is actually a case decision where a developer controlled an association chose not to buy insurance on the clubhouse. The clubhouse burned down, and the court said that he was not liable personally for the loss because he didn't benefit any differently than all the other unit owners. I think it was an absurd decision because the parties that have the liability and responsibility of buying insurance, of course, are members of the board of directors. I just talked about that, so we'll go past there. Ready to talk about assessment liabilities and lenders? I know it's tough. This isn't the sexy stuff you talk about when you start talking about legislation. But this is the stuff that controls. You know, condominiums are statutory creatures. They didn't exist in the common law. So condominium is a statutory form of property ownership, and they exist only by virtue of the fact we have a law enabling statutes that recognize the right to air right conveyance. And we also have a Cooperative Act, 719, and a Homeowners Association Act. First important change here, that lender safe harbor in condominiums where they only were liable to pay for 6 months of assessments. Good work, Harry. You guys helped get this one through. It's now 12 months. There's only a problem here. In this recent court decision, I think they were totally, totally wrong. Appeals court, just in the last week, said that where the declaration of covenants, conditions, and restrictions, same as the declaration of condominium, said that when the lender forecloses, the lender is not obligated for any of the assessments that were owed by the unit owner. The court ruled the contract controlled and not the statute, and forgave the lender the obligations to pay any of the assessments. Bad law is sometimes made by bad lawyering. And I unfortunately don't know whether this was argued to the court, but there is a rule of law. And the judge was here, he could tell you this. And that law is that statutory law is engrafted onto contracts that are entered into after the law becomes effective, whether or not it's stated in the contract or not. So we have a law in Florida that says if you are a lender and you foreclose against a condominium unit or a homeowner association and you foreclose against a home in your community, you're responsible to pay equal to 1 month's, of 1% of the original mortgage amount or 12 months of the assessments. As far as I'm concerned, the statutory law should apply to any mortgage that was entered into after the effective date of that law, regardless of what the condominium document says, or regardless of what the mortgage says. But last week, a court ruled otherwise. So I don't know what to tell you other than we're going to continue to push and say that that lender is responsible for the 12 months. Now, some of you have asked me this question. It's a good question. Let's assume you're already in foreclosure. Now we have July 1st a new law that says that lender has to pay 12 months instead of 6 months. Can we ask for the full 12 months? I'm saying ask for it. What is the bank going to say? But under what theory of law? Contract impairment. You see, there is a provision in Article 10 of the United States Constitution that says that no state can pass a law that impairs an existing contract. And so they're going to argue, well, look, that law you just passed, it may apply to mortgages I enter into after July 1, but my mortgage was entered into years ago, and this law doesn't apply. So notwithstanding the legislation, don't assume automatically that this is going to apply. Here's some fun things, but I don't know if they really mean anything. Doesn't it annoy you? You got unit owners that are living in your building. They're not paying their assessment. Their families are swimming at the swimming pool. And they're watching cable TV at night. And they cut it up to make sure you hear that they're listening to it. And you're paying for it. Can you cut off the cable? I had a condominium that was towing cars out of the parking lot, saying, if you're not going to pay, then you can't park in our common elements. And we have other condominiums that are taking away the, what do you call those little clickers, the transponders, is that the word? And say, if you're delinquent, you can't go to the residence line, you got to get in the guest line. And you, when your guests show up, we're not going to access them. You have to go down to the guardhouse and identify them and then walk them into the building. I don't know if any of that is legal, but here's what the legislature did, and I'll tell you whether or not any of this, I think, is going to really mean anything in the long run. First of all, homeowner associations. I hope we have some homeowner associations here. Anybody hear from a homeowner association, non-condo? Right now, you have unit owners who violate your rules and regulations, and you have a right to suspend them. You say you can't use the common amenities and the recreational hall and the clubhouse and everything else, right? You know what our legislators did? Whoever wrote this deleted that right in the homeowner association law. What they replaced it with was the parallel law they put into the condominium law that says if you're delinquent in paying your share of the common expense by more than 90 days. Now, here's an important change. It used to say if you were delinquent in paying your assessment. Now it says, and this is an important word, write it down, any monetary obligation. That's a good one. Liens, special assessments, fines, administrative late fees, legal fees, monetary obligations. If you're more than 90 days in paying those, the association, this law is parallel in the Condominium Act and the HOA Act. Again, the only thing is the HOA Act had the right to do it under rule violations, and they no longer have that right. You can deny unit owners the right, and their guests, and their invitees, all their family and friend, you can deny them the right to use any of the common areas, the common elements, or the recreational property. Let me tell you what you're not allowed to do by law. You can't break their legs. You cannot deny them access to their unit. You cannot deny them their parking space. You cannot deny them access to the elevator. You cannot say you have to walk up 25 flights of stairs. And here's the tricky one. You cannot deny them utility services. Question, is cable a utility? Don't know. A lot of the pundits say it is not, but here's what the problem is. Most of the providers today are doing what with services? They're bundling. So are cable. It's cable, high-speed internet, it's telephone. So bundled into this cable is these other services, which I think the courts and the division will say, you can't cut that off. And even if you could, most of the cable companies refuse to do so. They say it's just too logistically impossible to cherry-pick individual units and cut off cable but leave on other services. But at least in the short term, you can deny them use of those amenities. Now here's one that we all want, but I really wonder if it's not going to be a hornet's nest. You have a unit owner that is renting their unit. They're not paying their assessments. It bugs you. Of course it does. The tenant is enjoying the amenities. The unit owner is taking the money. They're not paying their assessments. There's a new law in condo. Someone asked me this question. It applies to co-ops. It applies to homeowner associations. It says that you have a right, association, to give a notice to the renter that they need to pay you, the association, that rent money from which you can extract the assessment owed to the association. This is going to be a great question to debate in one of my other hats. As you probably recall, I'm an adjunct law professor. My class starts again in August. I've been teaching for 30 years, and these are the types of issues we debate in the classroom, and no doubt will be argued in the courts. Let me ask you this question. Let's assume you're a landlord. You own a unit. You rent it out. The tenant has an obligation to pay you rent. And that tenant gets a letter from a stranger that he had no contact with, the association, saying, starting next week, send the rent money to me. You don't think there's going to be litigation over this? Is this an impairment of contract? Does an association want to step into the shoes of a landlord and be the landlord? Absolutely not. You don't want that exposure. So whatever you do, don't say we're now the landlord. I say try it until court says you cannot do it, but just understand the exposure. I think individuals will sue associations that extract the rent money where they have a contract that says the money belongs to them, and the theory that they'll argue is the association has other remedies of law, which is a remedy to lien and to foreclose, to take title to the unit, but you can't take out rent money. That's not permitted. I can't sit here and tell you exactly what's going to happen. This is fought for and pushed through, but like so much legislation, it will ultimately be filtered through the court system. Okay? So when you hear it, don't just jump up and down with glee and say this is great and here's the letters. I do want you to do this.
I want each of you to, as a condition of leasing units in your community, I don't want you to use a standard form lease. I want an addendum to the lease. The addendum to the lease says that the tenant recognizes that this is a condominium or homeowner association, there's underlying covenants, conditions, restrictions, and that the tenant agrees to abide by those rules and regulations, and in the event they do not, they are subject to being fined, which the law allows. And if the owner is delinquent in paying their share of the common expenses, the tenant, upon notice, will pay the association. That's a simple form. Do that right away. Do it before July the 1st. But just be aware that there is exposure in this area that you need to be concerned about. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on board vacancies. There's a provision that says if no more than an owner cannot serve, if you have a unit owned by two people, both can't serve on the board at the same time. They've changed that now to say unless you own more than one unit, in which case you both can qualify to serve. There's a provision that says that if there's a vacancy on the board, when there's an election and there's not enough people qualifying to run for the board, that the current directors are automatically reelected. You recall that? They've changed that. They take away the word automatic. In other words, it's still up to the directors who are not out of office or the members to determine who the board is. It's not an automatic reelection. Another important change in the law when it comes to directors, and this was some confusion in the law, is that condo, co-op, HOA, the director serves the remainder of the term of the vacancy. It used to be in some cases they'd serve until the next election. Now it's uniform, they serve the entire term of the vacancy. And that was another change in the law. Board members who are delinquent in paying their share of the common expenses, more than 90 days automatically off the board. Here's another change. Remember we talked before about changing the word from 90 days payment of assessment? It now says the same thing for directors. Any monetary obligation, any director who owes a monetary obligation to the association is automatically off the board. Oh, here's a good one I like. I know they quite understand it to start with. I don't know why. This was a Rabana bill that I never did fully support. If you are a director, you are responsible for making policy. It's not your job to sweep the walkways. You don't have to supervise the employees. A director is a policy-making body. They are fiduciaries of the unit owners. They act in their interests, but they're protected by a law that's inviolate. I just read two more cases on this. What is the law that gives directors the greatest protection? Does anyone know? It's a rule. What is the rule? Business judgment rule. You don't have to be a genius. You don't have to always be right. The courts have said unequivocally, we're not going to second guess the actions of a directors in making decisions governing the manner in which they determine to operate the condominium or homeowner association, as long as they're not guilty of self-dealing or fraud, as long as they're not taking money from the association for their own personal use or benefit. This isn't a test to see who are the
the brightest, the best, those who never make mistakes. That's not the role of a director. But we had a law that said that prior to running for the board, and even being elected, you had to sign an affidavit, a certificate saying that you had read the condominium and documents, you had understood them to the fullest of your ability, including the administrative rules and regulations. My friends, I told you I teach a class every year at Nova Law School. My average student grade is 50. And they want lay people to be able to certify that they're experts in condominium law. And this is just the amendments. You got to read the whole law. It's twice that size. Why in the world would a director need to understand how to calculate converter reserves? That's if you convert a building for rental to condominium. There's all statutory section on calculation of reserves. It's not necessary. Why does a director need to know how to file a condominium document or comply with disclosure requirements? They don't. So all that's been taken out of the law. Thank goodness. Now I have something to do as a lawyer. You know, there are two ways to get admitted to practice law in Florida. One is you graduate from an accredited law school, you take and pass the bar. The second way is to buy a condominium. So what does the law now require? After you're elected, you have to certify that you have read the condominium documents and you will uphold them to the best of your ability. I didn't ever quite understand that. What's wrong with running for the board saying, I don't like some of the restrictions that are in our documents? And part of my campaign is to amend some of these rules and regulations to make it more user-friendly. Why do you have to swear an oath that if I'm elected to the board, I'm going to uphold and defend the covenants and restrictions in the condominium documents? That doesn't make any sense to me. But that's one of the choices. Or in the alternative, you can take a approved educational course covering one of seven topics and certify that you have taken that class. New Neighborhoods is listed on the division's approved reading materials, and what we're trying to do with the help of Space Coast Community Association is allow for self-examination. It's a book you could buy for $10, $12. You can read it and take a 10-question exam. I think you get more out of this than reading the condominium documents, and I really do. I'm not just saying that because it gives you a better understanding of how all the pieces fit together. But that bit about reading the statute and the rules, that's out of the law now. You only have to certify after you're elected. Now let's look at these records. Confused yet? Try this. Union Attorney comes to you and they say, I know that I have a right of access to the books and records of associations, condo, co-op, HOA. This is the same. I want to know how much you're paying the manager. I want to look at their personnel file and see whether or not they have been guilty of any types of alleged improprieties in their conduct. I want to engage in a campaign to run for the board. I want all the information I can get on all the unit owners. I want their email addresses. I want their phone numbers. I want their bank account. I want their social security numbers. You know, The law says that every unit owner has a right to attend meetings of the board of directors, and they also have a right to video record those meetings. I do not make this up. One unit owner went to court over at a condominium in Paradise Lakes, located in Land Lakes, Florida, which is located just right outside of Tampa, Florida. They wanted to video the meeting. They said the statute says you have a right to video the meeting. There's only one problem. Paradise Lakes is a clothing optional community. You know, the division actually ruled there's no exception in the law, and that every owner has a right to videotape, so it's only by common courtesy that everyone's agreed not to bring cameras into their meetings. But the truth of the matter, with these little cameras today, who knows what people, you know, carry on. They got to, they're talking on their cell phone, they're probably video now. They have these little video cameras that are better than the old videos. Everybody's got their pet peeve about access to rules and regulations. There's now a list longer than my arm of what you cannot access and what the association may no longer allow unit owners to look at. You really need, if you're a manager, and I know we have a number of managers here, if you're the president, you need to just make this list up, get it out of statute, have it in front of you. Don't violate the law. You don't want individuals suing you for privacy. You don't want people suing you for alleged violations of the law. And I'm going to go through these with you, and I'm going to tell you and they're not all up on the screen, but we're going to go through them, and I'm going to tell you what you cannot. This is not what, if I don't say it, that means an owner can look at it. It used to be I would tell you a few things, but now it's so long, I'm going to tell you what you cannot allow owners to look at, which means that everything else they have a right to look at. Any record protected by the attorney-client privilege, again, not accessible to unit owners. When there's a rule, there's always an exception. Last week, a court ruled that where the board of directors at a meeting open to the owners, asked for a legal opinion regarding a particular matter, and the opinion was issued, that was not a attorney-client privileged communication, that owners could not see the opinion as written, in order that it be open for all owner inspection. So where that will lead to, I do not know. Information that is obtained is part of a application for sell, rent, or leasing of a unit. That does not include the actual lease itself. The division in arbitration has said that the lease itself, or the application to buy, the purchase agreement, is discoverable. But the information gathered, the financial information about the individual, known medical conditions, the background and history, that's protected. You may not share that information with the unit owners. Personnel records of the association employees, including but not limited to disciplinary actions, payroll, health insurance. I know I'm repeating myself, but I want to ingrain this. These are things you may not give to your unit owners.
Payroll.
Health insurance. Medical records of the unit owners. Is an important list. And I even made a mistake on this and on an opinion in my column I'm going to have to correct. Social Security numbers. I've already said you can't give that. But someone asked me whether or not they could require a driver's license, and I said I didn't see anything wrong with that. The law now says driver's license are protected. By the way, this doesn't mean the association cannot have this information and keep it in confidences in a manner to ensure that it's not accessible to the unit owners. This is what you may not disclose to other unit owners. Credit card numbers. Email addresses. One exception. What's the exception? Yes. If you say we want you to give us notice by email, then that email is public record until you specifically in writing say, I'm taking it back. Don't give this information out anymore. Email addresses. I'm happy to give you my bank account number. I have it set up for a special where you can only take deposits. Telephone numbers. Yes, telephone numbers. Emergency contact information. We're not even halfway through yet. This is ridiculous, isn't it? Any address of a unit owner other than that is provided to fulfill the association's notice requirements. Any other personal identifying information of any person other than what I call rank, file, and serial number. You can tell the unit owners of a unit, the unit address, and the unit. In other words, you can say, here's the owner of unit 2010 in building 5. That's it when it comes to identifying unit owner information. And here are two that were just added also. Any electronic security measures that is used by the association to safeguard data, including passwords. The software and operating systems used by the association, which allows manipulation of data, even if the owner owns a copy of the same software used by the association. All this is listed in the Act, and there's no doubt, knowing how good they are, that Roger will have these up on the community, the Space Coast Community Association website. You'll have a list of these lists of what is no longer accessible as part of the official records. A great place to look. What if unit owners get information and misuse it? The law now says that the association is not liable for misuse of information taken by a unit owner. Where's another protection in the law that I personally wrote into the law to protect associations against potential people suing an association for libel for words of unit owners? When you have your annual election and every unit owner is permitted to do a 8x11 sheet stating whatever they want to say in that sheet, there's specifically a law that says the association has no liability for disseminating that information. They're required by law to include it in the notice package. Speaking of notice packages, while I'm thinking about it, if you have in a homeowner association, there's specifically now a law that says any individual at the meeting at which you're having your elections has a right to nominate themselves to the board at the meeting. And if you're using secret ballots for the election of your directors, you must, as the condominiums do, have an outer envelope and an inner envelope for those ballots. Homeowner associations, this is new. You're at a meeting, you have your nominations, you're going to vote by ballot. You must have a ballot, and there must be an outer envelope in which the ballot is inserted in. The outer envelope will be signed by the unit owner and then is removed from the outer envelope, and the ballot is then put into a ballot envelope. I don't understand this amendment. I've read it a dozen times and I don't know what it does. There's a law in condominium that says that you cannot pass an amendment restricting the right to rent a unit or the term of the rental unless the individual consents to the amendment. But the amendment, if passed, applies to future buyers of the unit. What they did this year is to, what they said, narrow the impact of that law to say it only applies to amendments that restrict the term of the lease, restrict the number of times a year you can rent, and something else similar in nature. And I've been trying to scratch my head, and I'm trying to think, well, what else is there that you're going to amend? And then it's being promoted as softening the law. I don't understand what it does, to be honest with you, but the bottom line is I don't think it does anything. It cleans up, we say we'll call it a house cleaning amendment. Bottom line is, if you have a condominium and you're going to pass an amendment, previously you had a right to lease your unit, and now you want to pass an amendment to say no more leasing, no leasing for less than a term of 1 year, no more than twice a year, terms of less than 6 months. Bottom line, it only applies to all unit owners who consent to the amendment or those who buy after the amendment has become effective. This is a good one. Boy, Harry, you guys really worked overtime on this, these laws. No wonder they didn't pass a budget this year. They were too busy passing all this, right? You know, there's a law that says associations can enter into a bulk cable agreement and it's a common expense. That's been expanded now to say that not only is it for bulk cable, but it also includes television and telephones and internet. It's actually more complicated than that, and someone asked me in the notes if it included certain other things. Let me read exactly what it says, and the truth of the matter is I don't know fully what this includes, but here's what it says. If so provided in the declaration, the cost of communication services is defined in Chapter 202, information services or internet services obtained pursuant to bulk contract is a common expense. And the person wrote and said, does that include basic cable? What about premium? What about internet access? What about internet-based voice communications? I don't know. This is brand new, again, not effective to July 1st, and there hasn't been anything interpreting it. But it does say that right to enter into bulk cable is a common expense. It's now been expanded to include internet services as well as telephone services and other types of services, all of which will be a common expense. Real quickly, because I want to take time to answer some questions. Elevator inspections, you know, you've had a lot of you had the elevator companies coming around and telling you you have to retrofit your elevators. You have a little bit of a reprieve here, 5 years. Unless you're engaged in major renovation of the elevator.
It's that simple. 5 years to have it done, doesn't have to be done immediately, unless you're doing major renovations, in which case you then have to do the retrofitting at the same time you're doing the renovations. A couple more than the questions. We have if you're in a condominium, you have a right by statute since almost the inception of the Condominium Act, by a vote as required by the declaration or by approved by the membership to amend the declaration, to buy recreational amenities, clubhouses, land leases, and other amenities. That law did not extend over to homeowner associations. And over the course of years, we've been experiencing a problem of late, where a lot of these optional country club homeowner associations are beginning to lose their clubs and their golf courses due to the aging in place of the residents, a large number who are no longer supporting the amenities. And in order to save the amenities and also to preclude the golf courses from being built as additional residential buildings, the master associations began to enter into agreements to buy these amenities and then to impose the costs as a common expense among all the unit owners in the community. So you buy a home on a golf course with the expectation that it is going to be the view you'll have forever. And the next thing you know, you see a sign that the golf course clubhouse has been closed down, the property is sold, and a new development is coming up which will be blocking your view. Do you know in Florida there is no right to a view? That's the law. Famous case, the Fountain Blue and the Eden Rock Hotels. They sued each other when the first building was built and had a beautiful view of the ocean. They built the second building and had a wall up there, and so the people who were staying in that particular hotel were looking at a wall and not the ocean. And the court expressed, which is still the law of Florida, there is no right of a view in Florida. So if you buy property in Florida with the expectation that you're going to forever be able to see the forest and the ocean and the golf course, please understand there's nothing in the law that will assure you of that. So these individuals who had bought on these golf courses were finding that townhouses were springing up and the clubhouses were closing down. So there's a new law that effective July the 1st that parallels the Condominium Act. By the way, where they attempted to do this, the courts said the same thing. They said this is a fundamental change in the character of the community and therefore void and unenforceable. So effective July 1st, the HOA Act has taken the language from the Condominium Act, and specifically by law, the association, and I want to read a couple of passages to this to you. An association may enter into an agreement to acquire leasehold, memberships, other possessory or use interests in lands or facilities, including but not limited to country clubs, golf courses, marinas, submerged lands, parking areas, conservation areas, and other recreational facilities. The vote to do so is the vote to amend the declaration to permit the right to do so. One thing about flagpoles, there was a lot of litigation in Florida about in a homeowner association situation, the right of individuals to put up a flagpole and fly the American flag. The law has now been changed to give the association some discretion as far as requiring the setback requirements and the physical locations where those flagpoles can be erected. I got a letter the other day, which I'll be responding to in one of my upcoming columns, about a
a unit owner who wanted to dry her clothing on clotheslines. And she lives in a planned development governed by a homeowner association. And she says that she puts up one of those retractable clotheslines, and the association has told her that she has to move it somewhere where it's not visible to others in the community. Understand, in Florida, the law specifically says that every homeowner has a right to put up clotheslines and to have energy-saving devices like solar panels, or probably even water-gathering equipment. And no covenant condition or restriction can preclude you from doing so. I actually had a manager who told a unit owner that while she could put up her clothesline, she couldn't hang clothes on it. I wrote, makes about as much sense as saying that your dog must be on a leash, but you cannot put a dog within the leash. Same thing. Okay. I think we've covered enough. They say the mind can absorb what the seat can endure. And no doubt, your seats are getting sore. What I'm going to do now is, there were some pre-questions that were submitted to me. I'm going to answer them and then answer any other questions you have. By the way, before I leave here today, again, we have some copies of New Neighborhoods in the back where my wife is, and if anybody wanted them personalized, they are signed by the author. I'll be happy to do that. And again, part of the proceeds does go to the Space Coast Community Association. Do pick up the disaster preparedness brochure. There's still some back there. They're absolutely free. If you need more, we'll send them up to your association. Okay, we'll do as many of these as possible. I was told the hook comes out at 11:45 when you have to close up. Roger, do me a favor and disconnect that.
Would you like?
Yeah, just... Did you want to stand up and stretch your leg for a second? Just say, take 2 minute break. And then we'll do the questions.
Move this poster here, guys.
I speak extemporaneous.
Could I ask you a question?
Your firm has gone through the lien letter.
They didn't say that it would expire in a year. And now I understand that if it expires, what happens after we file
another lien?
Association.
I asked one of these people that question and said I couldn't be fine.
Okay. I'll call the clerk.
Okay. I can do that.
Yes, you can.
So I don't have to foreclose to protect
one. You can foreclose within 1 year. But we take a file of the lien, all the updated information.
There was a gentleman who was standing here with a book I wanted to
I'm sorry, if someone had a book they wanted me to sign, was that...
Run a little long with our work. Let
me get a pen. do I write that to? What's your name?
Yeah.
Bob?
Yes, that's good. Instead of a collection book.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
What's
your name? Jim. Jason. Thank you so much, sir. Enjoy reading it. And what is your first name?
Jim.
Jim, J-I-M. J-I-M. First name.
Jim.
J-I-M. And your first name?
Norm.
N-O-R-M? Thank you very much. Enjoy reading.
Will you speak about the enforcement mechanisms and how do you enforce? Do we call the police? Do we find people that...
I'm going to try to answer some of the questions. Okay, we have a... I'm going to take these questions. I have a limited amount of time. I'm going to run down those that were submitted to me. Thank you so much. Question number one. Considering the removal of an association's ability to determine that HO6 policies are enforced and requirements to assess the membership ability to cover insurance deductibles, do you recommend the association modify the documents to allow verification the HO6 policies are in place? I said that earlier on, notwithstanding the fact that you cannot force in place insurance, I see nothing wrong with the boards having a rule and regulation or an amendment to their documents requiring that every owner furnish the association evidence that they have an HO6 policy in place. Question number two. With the removal or automatic appointment of a director to serve following the term of other members running for the election as replacement, with the provision making an existing director eligible for reappointment to the board if no one runs, what is the accepted method for making an appointment of the old member who would make the appointment? The answer is the remaining directors, even though less than a quorum, can fill the vacancies on the board. If the entire board is vacant because of the expiration, then I would have the membership vote. Remember, it's only 20% required. So you would have the names of the candidates verified by the membership. But keep in mind, if the number of directors equals the number of vacancies and there's no others, then they're automatically reelected. I've answered some of these already in my speech and questions, so I'm skipping down about the collecting rent from the tenants. I think we covered that. Here's dry out payment responsibility. Unit is flooded through either storm or plumbing failure. Typical damage for association, wall, board, and unit, wall coverings, floor coverings. Typically, the association coordinates dryouts to mitigate damages. Who pays the dryout, the association or the unit owners? Mitigation of damages, which includes following a hurricane, the removal of carpeting and the sheetrock, is an association responsibility, and they have a right by law to enter every unit and to mitigate damage, which means to dry out and to close in. Dry out means to remove the wet carpeting, remove the wet sheetrock to preclude the growth of mold, and to the expense is a common expense of the association. The cost of replacing the carpeting is a unit owner expense. the cost of mitigation of damages to preclude spreading mold to the condominium is the association obligation. There's a big difference there. The question we'll ask is the cooperative law, same as the condo law, and that allows collecting a rent. The answer, I said yes. Rent, that rent provision applies for both condos, co-ops, and HOAs. What should an association do if an owner files bankruptcy? The association, by operation of federal law, at that moment can do nothing. They can file no pleadings. They can take no legal action without leave of the bankruptcy court. What you do is you file a petition for the court asking the court to permit the receiver to collect the current assessments that are owed going forward. Collecting the past assessments become another issue. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but I want to tell you that in the last year, I've seen more bankruptcies filed by community associations in the prior 40 years. And one case that really astonishes me, and I'm not sure what the net result of this is going to be, is that at the Mason Grun condominium located on Miami Beach, Florida, a federal bankruptcy court has set aside a 99-year land lease on which leasehold property is included in addition to the recreational amenity, most of the parking areas of the condominium. The first year under that lease, the monthly payments were $21,000. The monthly payments at the time the bankruptcy court voided the obligation was $121,000 a month. I have no idea where that community is going. The court said the developer, lessor, still had rights against the individual unit owners who wanted to park on his property. I thought it's still his property. But we're seeing more and more bankruptcy court cases being filed for associations to get out of contracts that they had entered into as a means of curbing the cost of some of their agreements due to the shortness of cash to run the association. There's a whole series of questions here about what you can do about lenders to expedite the filing of foreclosures and taking title. Let me tell you, the courts have ruled there is nothing you can do. I have heard of two individual firms, law firms, who have come up with what they thought were creative solutions. What they did is what they called, and they coined the expression, reverse mortgage foreclosure. They took the approach that when they were named by the lender in foreclosure in the foreclosure action to concede the fact that the first mortgage holder had a priority claim right over them, and they in turn then deeded the unit, their interest, to the mortgage holder. And from that point forward, started assessing the mortgagee for the share of the common expenses. The court voided that action. And I told a reporter on the phone the other day, I said, let me try to explain it to you this way. Let's say that I gave you a deed to the Brooklyn Bridge. And that I then said, because you own the bridge, you're now responsible for the maintenance or restoration of that bridge. Because I gave you the deed, does that mean you're responsible? The answer is no, because one of the elements of conveyance is the consent of the party taking title. They have to agree to the title. So the court said, you can't just say that we're deeding over our interest to the bank, and therefore they're now a unit owner. The bank has to determine that it wishes to take title and is agreeable to do so, including all the consequences of owning title. A second action that I have seen taken by a trial court was to say to a lender, if you do not expedite your foreclosure, we are going to start charging you your share of the common expenses, even though you're not an owner.
Third District Court of Appeals said there is no provision in law, no matter how admirable the idea might be, that can compel a party that has no legal obligations to take action that's not required to be taken under their instrument, in this case the mortgage. So the action to try to compel them to expedite the foreclosure was voided by the courts. Question here is cutting off a table. We've already answered that one. Does the new law allow buildings under 75 feet to opt out? I think I answered that one. Can an owner install a TV dish and attach it with bolts to a barrier wall separating two balconies? Under the Telecommunication Act of 96? I forget the year now.
91.
What is the year?
91.
Was that the year? Telecommunication Act was the one that says that those covenants, conditions, restrictions that precluded putting up of satellite dishes and antennas were all voided ab initio. Unit owners have a right to put up a satellite dish, which was a 2 meter in diameter. The FCC, at the insistence of community associations for architectural control, has changed the rules to provide. If you have a master TV antenna system that allows a unit owner to get the same access to services that they could get from an individual dish, you can restrict individual dishes from being put up along the property. But if you cannot get the same services, then an individual has a right to put up a dish on the property that they own exclusively, such as in a homeowner association or a lot or a condominium on the part of the property that they have the exclusive use of. If a change is made to the exterior look of the building, but it's a safety issue, does the board have to put it to the unit owner? Court case has held that changing the color of the paint of a building is a material alteration requiring the consent of the unit owners unless your documents provide otherwise. So any type of a change to the exterior, including to the pavements, the carpeting, the manner of structural components are deemed to be material alterations requiring approval of the unit owners. Let's take two or three more. The voice is going to give out.
Does that include the door?
The front door. It doesn't preclude you from making from maintenance of necessary maintenance. And it really then gets into a refined area. For example, I've had situations where engineers have come in and they've said that where they have these railings that are made out of concrete, or they might have been out of metal and they were corroding because of the salt water. For the safety purposes, they recommend changing to, I think it was metal as opposed to the concrete, or it might have been concrete from metal. And we took the position that since it was a safety issue, that the board had the right to make the change. And there is an arbitration decision that says you don't have to sit with outdated styles, and they permit an association to change Chattahoochee to a updated marble, and they said this was not a material alteration or change. So there are a variety of cases that give you some latitude in some of these areas. For a condominium to vote to opt out of the elevator emergency backup, does that include fire alarm systems? I think I answered that. The elevator is not an opt-out. The elevator gives you 5 years unless you're doing a major repair. The opting out is of the fire system unless it's an engineered life safety system in which your local fire marshal deems it necessary. Our board wants to have vendors that are not licensed insured. What's wrong with that? It's not permitted by law. Plain and simple. If the building codes all require that anyone in contract or doing work on your property has to be licensed and insured. And it holds the party who hires a person who is not licensed and insured liable for doing so.
How do you get owners to purchase insurance since you can't force place insurance? The truth of the matter is by education and making them aware of the fact that in the event of a casualty, the association is not responsible to replace the listed items, and therefore if they want to restore the unit, including maintain the unit value, they're going to have to buy homeowners insurance. Have you heard or are you aware of any code involving mechanical ventilation for, maybe you can read that. What is it? What does that say? What kind of... I'll have Roger come up and read that one for me. This is the inspection reports every 5 years. That's been repealed. Someone asked that question. Good question. I didn't mention that. That report just said you had to have your building inspected every 5 years. That has been repealed. This is I manage a timeshare resort. We are located in RMN2 zoning. We have many concerns about being required to apply for special exemption transient lodging permit. The timeshares are regulated by the hotel resort laws. They're required to, if you have leases that are less than, 6 months, you're required to collect sales taxes. And they're governed by the different laws than the condominium laws. And that's just the way it is. Let's say two more here. Can you cut off bulk cable? I've already answered that. There are some that say yes, but I don't know if you can do it with its bundle. Do you know what that says?
Ventilators.
Ventilators from closed stairwells.
You know, I had someone ask me this question. They wanted to know whether or not I'm familiar with the new requirements by some of the local fire marshals that you have ventilators for enclosed stairwells. I've asked around, and I've not been able to find out any information on that. Does anyone here have any information they want to share with the audience about apparently some associations are being required to put in ventilators in enclosed stairwells? I don't know. This is what someone has been asking. They're asking, do we know of anybody that has any information on this? I've asked around. I'm sorry. I haven't been able to get the answer to that. Grandfathering rental restriction, does this apply to limiting the number or percent of units that can be leased? That's a very good question. I said before I wasn't sure what the intent of the change of the law is. Can you restrict the total number of units that can be leased in a condominium? Would that be outside of the scope of that which would not apply to all owners? I'd say that's a good question, and that could be something that could be passed and arguably would be something that would not be subject to approval of the membership insofar as not applying to every owner. In other words, putting a cap of the total number of units that could be rented. Good question. I'm going to bounce that around to some of my partners, because I like that question. All right, let's do one last one. Monetary obligations associated with bankruptcy, the answer is yes. You can petition the court to require the bankrupt to pay their assessments prospectively, not retroactively. Can we charge interest and late fees on HOA fees on the bank's 6 months prior? The bank is only liable for, as I said, up to 12 months of assessment, not late fees and interest. That's set by statute, and that's all you're allowed to charge them.
Attorney fees?
Not even attorney fees. What's the advantage of filing your rules and regulations in the circuit court? We'll do this as the last answer. There are two types of covenants, and they're written about, we talk about this in new neighborhoods. There are rules and regulations that are made by the board and are not recorded a public record. Those are called Class 2 covenants. test is one of reasonableness, whether they are reasonable in their application. And then there is those covenants that are recorded in the public records. Those are Class 1 covenants, and they're deemed to be enforceable so long as they do not violate fundamental rights. So covenants that are recorded in the courts have higher value than do the covenant of enforceability, than do the covenants that are not part of the rules and regulations made by the board. Keep in mind that a rule and regulation cannot circumvent a right that is expressly granted by the documents or inferred from the documents. Let me give you the classic example. You do not have a restriction in your documents against pets. There's nothing that says anything about pets at board besides the passer restriction saying no pets permitted in the building. That rule would be unenforceable because the covenants have higher priority. And if they are silent on the subject, then it's deemed that the owner would be permitted to have a pet. Now you go to the other extreme, you have a situation where you have a restriction against pets altogether. No pets permitted in this condominium. You still have to deal with the Fair Housing Act that allows an individual with a handicap to have a pet if they can demonstrate that the pet is necessary to ameliorate a condition that they have, such as a sight-impaired person or a hearing-impaired person. And while we often think of pets, service animals, in terms of dogs, we're dealing with them in condominiums where there are monkeys that have been trained to fetch items. I've seen recently a organization that is promoting miniature horses as a type of permitted service animal. And I actually saw a show on television where a woman was walking a miniature horse around a supermarket. Now, let me give you another example in this area. There's a woman, she had a phobia, and I'm not sure what you call it. My son tells me, and I can just never remember, but she has a fear of contact with people. And when she goes out, she has a trained Doberman pincher. And the Doberman pincher, this is for real, the Doberman pincher is trained to circle her. And it takes its mouth and it shows its fangs, and it's designed to keep people from getting too close. She went over to a drugstore. She wanted to shop. And the people were afraid of her and the dog, and she had the paperwork to show that she was handicapped. She had this phobia. She explained what the purpose of the dog was, and the manager said, "Look, our other customers are afraid. What we're going to do is you give us a list of what you want, and we'll go pull the items from the shelf. We'll bring them up here. We'll check you out, and we'll take care of you." She said, "That's not acceptable. I have a right to walk through the store with my dog. My dog will not bite anyone. He's designed to keep people away from me." And guess what? She prevailed in court on that. So what the law says is that an association, even if it has a no pet restriction, must make reasonable accommodations in its rules and practices to allow a handicapped person, when needed, to have either a service animal or an emotional support animal for depression, anxiety, loneliness, rheumatoid arthritis. But a recent court decision said the following, I will end on this. The association has a right to inquire of the nature of the handicap. It also has a right to determine how the animal will ameliorate the conditions the person says that they have. The person cannot say to you, "I'm not telling you what my condition is." They have to tell you. They have to tell you what the animal can do for them. And when you get the letter from the doctor that says, "I'm prescribing this pet for this person," you have a right under a federal decision out of the Northern District of Florida to inquire of the doctor's background and training and experience the degree to which he has seen and treated the patient, and whether or not he has the training to be able to prescribe a pet to do what it is this person is claiming the pet is capable of doing. That's a major change in the law that has occurred in the last 6 or 7 months. Previously, HUD's position was if a unit owner gives us a doctor's letter, we are going to say you must allow that pet in your condominium. I haven't figured out how to deal with the problem where I've told you I've got letters from lawyers saying my client moved into this building because it's a pet-free building. They have fear of animals. They have allergies to animals. We moved here because it was going to be pet-free, and now there are pets there because the individual is qualified for a pet under any handicap laws. HUD has not addressed that issue. Okay? All right, I think that's pretty much covers. I'm out of breath, and I've got to drive back. I'm driving back to South Florida and heading out. I'm taking a vacation, heading out to Colorado. Thank you very much. I enjoyed the opportunity. Well, you can't get any better information than what you got here today. I want to let you know that there's DVDs are available for this presentation. If you would like, the cost is $15. Send me an email at rk-scca.cfl.lr.com. You got Gary's books are still over there up for sale. There'll be a board meeting for the SCCA board in the back. Directly after this meeting, we have room for about 6 guests. Our next meeting, can we keep it down for 1 second, please? Our next meeting, because we do not meet in July and August, will be September 18th. We're going to have Mr. Pete Dunbar from the state explaining and going over the new condo concepts book. And there will also be a second meeting in that month on the 25th of September, all about cash versus accrual and your budgeting and pooled reserves. All of this will be noted on the website. You can get all your current information directly off of our website. The new schedule for meetings will be posted probably by the middle of July. Thank you very much for coming, and I hope you all enjoyed yourself. Have a great weekend. Thank you.